Thank you for sitting. Thank you for being here. Okay, well, back to our job of reading The Awakening of Faith. John Hyde reminded me that there's a translation of the text that was done around the turn of the century, the last century, by D.T. Suzuki, and I was able to download it. You can download it. So I was reading it on my iPad here. And in 1900 or so, D.T. Suzuki just assumed that the author of the text was Ashvagosa, like everyone always said it was. I guess in 1900, scholars were less skeptical than they are now. Now scholars are very suspicious and doubt everything. So in his introduction, Suzuki Roshi, not Suzuki Roshi, Suzuki, D.T. Suzuki, assumes that the author is Ashvagosa. And so he says a lot of stuff in his introduction about Ashvagosa. And as I was reading that, I began to slowly become somewhat convinced, well, maybe the author really is Ashvagosa. And in a way, you know, that makes sense to me because Ashvagosa lived in the first century. And a lot of people who think that the text was originated in China would date it several hundred years later. And it does sound a little bit like an archaic, really early text to me. So now, anyway, I'm just letting you know that I'm a convert to the unpopular belief that Ashvagosa is actually the author of this text. Okay, since we haven't talked about it for a couple of weeks, I'm going to review very quickly from the beginning, just to set the context. So, the awakening of faith in the Mahayana. And in this case, Mahayana doesn't mean Mahayana Buddhism as a school of Buddhism. Mahayana means mind, the great mind. And the text is about how this great mind, which is inherently awakened and perfect, unfolds into the world that we live in. So it begins by dividing mind into two aspects, A, transcendent, and B, phenomenal. And the transcendent, you know, is beyond thought, beyond conceptualization, beyond perception, so there's not a whole lot you can say about it. So he polishes that off pretty quickly. But then there's a lot to say about mind in terms of phenomena. And so the first point of discussion in mind in terms of phenomena is the storehouse consciousness, which is the way the mind manifests as the world. And the storehouse consciousness has two aspects. First, the aspect of enlightenment, and that's what we talked about last time, a couple of weeks ago. And that includes the original enlightenment, which means the fact that things are by their nature. Reality is what is meant by all these words like nirvana, Buddha, awakening. That those are just names for the actual nature of reality as it is. That's original enlightenment. And the second aspect of the storehouse consciousness in its enlightened dimension is the actualization of enlightenment, which itself includes three subtopics: purity of wisdom, supra-rational functions, so, you know, amazing things happen, and third, characteristics, what they call characteristics of enlightenment. And you remember that was just a series of mirror metaphors about how the mind reflects the world and the world reflects the mind. Anyway, I'm not saying too much there, it's pretty sketchy, but just to remind you, that's where we're at. Now we come to the second aspect of the storehouse consciousness. All that was the enlightened aspect of the storehouse consciousness. Now we come to the non-enlightened aspect. And now this is important for us because that's us, right? We're the non-enlightened storehouse consciousness type of people. So here's where the text begins. Because, and I'm using the not D.T. Suzuki, but the Hikeda translation that we've been using all along. Because of not truly realizing oneness with suchness, there emerges an unenlightened mind and, consequently, its thoughts. These thoughts do not have any validity to be substantiated. Therefore, they are not independent of the original enlightenment. It is like the case of a man who has lost his way. He is confused because of his wrong sense of direction. If he would be freed from the notion of direction altogether, then there would be no such thing as going astray. And it's the same with people. Because of the notion of enlightenment, they are confused. But if they are freed from the fixed notion of enlightenment, then there will be no such thing as non-enlightenment. So how about that? That is very illuminating to me. It begins by saying, the whole problem is because of not truly realizing oneness with suchness. So what would that mean? Realizing oneness with suchness. So it seems to me like this is, you know, a really big thing. It's the main thing, but also it's not such a big thing, because suchness is not an object. It's not an experience. It's not a state. It can't be described or known. We can't experience it. In a way, you know, as we've said before, you could say, well, it's so irrelevant, why even have an idea of it or a concept of it? It seems ridiculous. But the thing is that I think we can somehow touch it, somehow in a very vague way, maybe an uncanny way, we can realize it with our body. A phrase that Suzuki Roshi used a lot, and I remember in the early days at the Zen Center, people imitating him would use this phrase a lot, some feeling. There's some feeling that we have in and around our ordinary everyday experience. Maybe we could say, if we wanted to try to say something about it, which would not be entirely right, but maybe we could say it's a profound sense of just really, really, really and truly being here, where we are. A deeper and more grounded sense than we usually feel. I mean, I'm sure all of you have felt this from time to time, but it's not the way we usually feel. Because, you know, when usually on an everyday basis, of course, we're here. If we're not sleeping, we're conscious, we know, we can say, I'm in this room, I'm doing this, I'm doing that. We know we're here, but not that much, right? Not that much. Because our mind is in several places at once, you know, we're distracted, we're uncertain. Maybe without realizing it, we're comparing, without knowing we're comparing, to someone else or some other person we could be or some other place we could be, or, you know what I mean? We're not entirely 100% committed to being as and where we are. But if we would be completely and utterly here without anything extra or any wish for something that's incomplete, as if anything was incomplete, with everything that we have given completely to being here, maybe that would be in a simple-minded way what this lofty phrase means, realizing oneness with suchness. I don't know if that's true, but it seems that way to me. That's how I, when I hear that phrase and when I think about it, that's what it means to me. And it's something, like I say, that I think we've all felt from time to time. It also comes with it a profound sense of peacefulness and completion, as if there's nowhere else to be, nothing else to do. Everything is just as it is. But when we don't realize oneness with suchness, which is the ordinary condition, then, as the text says, there emerges an unenlightened mind with thoughts. And these thoughts don't have any verifiable validity. In other words, they are very real because there they are. They're floating around there in our heads. It's just that they don't refer to the things we think they refer to. We think that the things they refer to are real, but the things they refer to are not real. The thoughts are just there, and they're as real as anything, but the thing the thoughts refer to is not real. So we experience our thoughts, and we're motivated by our thoughts, and they get us to do stuff, and they disturb us and all kinds of things. But the basis for those thoughts that we are so convinced is there, is not there. But, and this is what I find so wonderful in this passage, but also there's no basis for anything else. It's not just that our thoughts have no basis, it's that nothing has any basis, including all of reality, including Buddha and all of awakening, including the transcendent. And that's why our thoughts and our ordinary unenlightened experiences are not at all different from transcendence or true reality. There's not any difference there. The only difference is that we fully believe that there's a difference. And that's where the problems come from. In other words, although we are actually, and this is all over Suzuki Roshi, all over Suzuki Roshi, even though we're really in the condition of awakening now, we really, really are, we are prevented from appreciating this all the time because we don't believe it and we don't see it. This, by the way, gives you a little insight into the pungency of the title, The Awakening of Faith in the Mahayana. In other words, we have a tremendous amount of faith in our suffering conditioned reality. We have an enormous amount of faith, which according to the text is completely unfounded, in the suffering painful world, which we have invested with all our belief. And Ashvaghosa wants to get us to not have faith in that, but instead have faith in the Mahayana, the real nature of mind, which is peaceful and liberated. And imagine what the difference would be if we had faith in that instead of in the ordinary conventional world that we so passionately believe in, even though in fact there are no good reasons for believing in it. Then Ashvaghosa gives the example of a person who's lost. It's a great example. And I know you've had this experience. I certainly have. You're trying to get somewhere. You know, your mind is half in that place that you're trying to get, but you're not there yet, and you're late, and you're lost, and you have no idea how you're going to get there. Steve and I had that, you know, we were lost in San Francisco trying to get to the East Bay to a poetry reading, and we were lost, you know, and it was a very uncomfortable feeling. You don't like that feeling, right? But if you ever, in the midst of that feeling, realized and then really remembered, and I do remember this from time to time when I'm lost, that of course you know exactly where you are. You're not lost. How could you be lost? You're right here. You're not lost. You're here. We're the same place that you were the whole time, and the same place that you'll be when and if you ever get there. So you can't be lost. And there is no cause for anxiety whatsoever. And it's only because you insist that you're supposed to be somewhere else even though you're not, that you call yourself lost. And then you have this very, very uncomfortable feeling that's 100% unnecessary and quite foolish. It doesn't help you, by the way, get to where you want to get, does it? In any case, Ashwagosa is here saying that the person has a sense of direction. That's why he seems to be lost. But if he had no sense of direction, he couldn't be lost. And, you know, when you think about it, there's no direction in being here. When you're here, you know, there's no direction. You're just here. There's no other place to be, to point toward. And there's never any place else to be. Now, I myself have a colossally bad sense of direction. I could almost count on it. You know, if I want to turn left, it's probably right. You know, that's how bad my sense of direction is. And like my other shortcomings, I would like to attribute this to my excellent Zen mind, but I'm afraid not. I'm afraid it's just a shortcoming. But it's true, you know, if you are trying to get somewhere, you can get lost all the time. But if you're not trying to get anywhere, then you're always going to be exactly where you need to be, even if you're sort of lost conventionally. In truth, you're not lost. And when you know that truth, you're never anxious about it. Now, of course, practically speaking, as you're probably thinking right now, in our ordinary lives, yeah, we have to go places and do things and be there and find a way to get there. I know that, but I think that it is actually possible, despite this practical fact, that we could take this teaching to heart simply by holding all of our needs to be somewhere and accomplish something very, very lightly. Never forgetting the truth that we are always where we need to be, and that what needs to be done, what really, really needs to be done, is always already done. I actually think it's possible to live with this in mind. And insofar as you can do this, it takes the edge off the anxiety quite a bit. You don't feel anxious anymore. You don't feel like, oh no, there's no oh no anymore. Or if there is an oh no, and you train your mind in this way, it's very easy to kind of catch yourself and say, wow, you know, why would I want to make that problem for myself? Why don't I just relax? Next thing Ashwagosa says is this sentence: because there are people of unenlightened, deluded mind, for them we speak of true enlightenment, knowing well what this relative term stands for. Isn't that amazing? All of this stuff about enlightenment all over Buddhism. He's saying that the only reason that the term enlightenment was invented was to help out poor, deluded people like us. Because there's really no such thing as enlightenment. He's saying it pretty straightforwardly. There's no such thing, but it seemed necessary to create such an idea to help us out. Now, at first, when you think about it, so you say, well, this is not helping me out, this idea of enlightenment. It's only making things worse because, you know, I was bad off before, but now I have an extra problem. Now I have to get enlightened and I'm not. You know, now I feel even worse. So it might be creating a problem without anything helping. But on the other hand, when you think about it, no, you know, the idea of Buddhist enlightenment is very inspiring. You know, it's very, very inspiring. When we read the Dhammapada and we read all about, you know, a peaceful life of unbinding and liberation, it's very inspiring. And it gives us hope, right? It gives us incentive. It gets us to do the practice. And isn't that really true? I mean, think about it. Don't we all practice with some hope for improvement or illumination, we don't know what exactly, but something positive that we could hope to obtain or are obtaining maybe from practicing. So isn't this fiction that there's somewhere to get a useful fiction. And even though it presents the kind of problems that I mentioned a minute ago, and there's probably no way around, to get around those problems, actually it's a good idea. Because we do feel, you know, people tell me all the time, oh, I love to practice, it's helped me so much. People tell me that all the time. And I realize, you know, no, it didn't help you at all, you know, and you were fine to begin with. But nevertheless, people feel that way. I feel that way, right? And it really is encouraging. And we do feel like we're growing and we're changing. And even if we really aren't growing and changing, it's really a good thing to think that. And it makes us happy to think that. It makes us more relaxed and more kind to ourselves and to one another. So the word enlightenment is just like a big cipher. But it does, it's saying that, yeah, there's promise that we can have some peace. And that's a lot. That's doing a lot. That's a lot of good work that word is doing. And even though, you know, I can tell you that after spending my whole life doing the practice full time, you look back and you think, well, you know, actually not much has changed. You know, I'm pretty much the same as I was, you know, 50 years ago or so, 60 years ago. I haven't changed that much. Still, probably we're all somewhat different from what we were, and it's very paradoxical that we are very different and not at all different. There's so many paradoxes in life, you know, and in the life of practice. I think practice makes us see the paradoxes that maybe we covered up with our smart minds. Because I think what Ashwagosa is saying and what Dogen is saying and what Suzuki Roshi certainly says all the time, in fact, life, being alive as a human being, is very paradoxical. It doesn't really add up in the way that we think it adds up. And I think when we're practicing, we're really ready to be cognizant of that and let that be the case and not try to figure it out. The text continues, independent of the unenlightened mind, there are no independent marks of true enlightenment that can be discussed. Independent of the unenlightened mind, there are no independent marks of true enlightenment itself that can be discussed. So there are no marks of enlightenment other than the unenlightenment. You want to see what enlightenment is? Just open your eyes and look. It's right there. According to Ashwagosa, there are no other marks of true enlightenment other than this. Because true enlightenment and enlightenment are identical. In other words, they're not like a whole series of realities. There's just one reality. And people look at it in different ways and experience it in different ways, but it's really one reality. And it's just that. It's a matter of how do we hold this reality in our hand, and how do we regard this reality, and how do we live it, how do we feel in it. And I think that this is the source of the great patience and compassion of the Buddhas, who know that they are no different, absolutely no different at all from anyone or anything else. That's the great wisdom of the Buddha. The rest of us, you know, think we're different. Maybe better than, worse than, but different. The Buddha sees no difference. That's why in the Zen version of the Buddha's awakening story, he says at the moment of awakening, how wonderful, I and all beings together are awakened in this moment. He doesn't say, wow, you know, I'm so great, I just got enlightened, and everybody else is just a mess. He says, no, I and all beings in this moment are awakened. So next, Ashwagosa is now starting to explain how this wonderful thing devolves step by step into this unenlightened world. So at this point, we can talk about unenlightenment. Not that there is actually such thing as unenlightenment, just as there's no such thing as enlightenment. But at this point, we think that there is such a thing, and so we're kind of stuck in this unenlightened world. And here's what he says. Because of its unenlightened state, the deluded mind produces three aspects which are bound to non-enlightenment and are inseparable from it. First is the activity of ignorance, the agitation of mind. Because of its non-enlightened state is called activity. When enlightened, it is completely unagitated. When it is agitated, anxiety follows. Anxiety here being a translation for dukkha or suffering. For the result, anxiety is not independent of the cause, the agitation contingent upon ignorance. So here, ignorance, which is a technical word in Buddhism, without vision, blind, is exactly the erroneous idea that there's a difference between unenlightenment and enlightenment. We're ignorant. We think there's enlightenment and we're not enlightenment. We're not enlightened. And this is not, you know, I mean, you may think, well, I never had that idea. But the idea here is that it's baked into our human body and our whole human organism. Maybe we don't use that language. Maybe the word enlightenment is not something we think about. But what Buddha is saying here is this is baked into the human organism, this confusion, this ignorance. And it causes a kind of flurry or flailing about that we call ordinary human life. And that seems about right. I mean, this is a world of everybody flailing about. This is a world that there's fundamental anxiety caused by ignorance. And that fundamental anxiety that's there all the time, sometimes really bad, sometimes unnoticeable, is called dukkha or suffering. He goes on. Second is the perceiving subject. Because of the agitation that breaks the original unity with suchness, there appears the perceiving subject. When unagitated, the mind is free from perceiving. So once that initial flailing takes place, it leads to the creation of a perceiving subject, meaning you and me over here, apart from one another and apart from the world out there. In other words, an inner life appears, and then the rest of the world appears as outer world. When the mind recognizes what it really is, the passage says, there is not this agitation. And so there's no inner life and outer life. As soon as there's inner life and outer life, there's threat, attack, and defense, and pain, you know. So there's no inner life and outer life. There's just simply what happens. Happenstance, 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 happenstance. That's it. Maybe you noticed here a subtle point. Not being one with suchness causes ignorance. Ignorance causes agitation. Agitation breaks the original oneness with suchness. So this is like a two-way causation, a complex causation. The cause causes the effect, and the effect causes the cause. It kind of goes both ways. It's a kind of a unvirtuous circle. Third is the world of objects. So yeah, as soon as there's a perceiving subject, then there's a world of objects. That isn't really there, but we project it to be there. In psychology, they have, you know, the idea of projection. You project your past history onto something in the present that isn't that. Well, in Buddhism, everything is projection. The whole world is projection. In just the same sense. It's not really happening in the way you think it's happening. There is no world of objects. Because of the creation of a perceiving subject, there's the world of objects. The object is just everything that isn't the subject. And when there's a subject, there's going to be an object. When the text says there's no perceiving, which is often said, you know, non-perception, I don't think it means a big blank nothing. I think it means non-perception in a technical sense, and maybe in a felt sense. Maybe we can feel this. Sometimes, and I've heard people talk about this, you know, having the experience of completely merging with that which they perceive. Sometimes when we're in love with someone, we have the feeling of merging with that person in a moment, or merging with a tree or a cloud. No perception, no perceiver, nothing perceived, everything just there. No sense of direction, no sense of desire, no sense of action needed. But here we're talking about, no, this is all established, and it's agitating. Agitation, perceiver, object of perception. And then it gets worse. He says, conditioned by the incorrectly conceived world of objects, the deluded mind produces six aspects. So, six aspects. First, the aspect of the discriminating intellect. Depending on the erroneously conceived world of objects, the mind develops the discrimination between liking and disliking. So we've heard about this before, right? And this is really important. So once there's a subject and an object, and once there's perception, there's going to be discrimination. Because that's what perception is. It's discrimination. One thing is different from another. That's how I can tell what it is. And that's intelligence. And intelligence has the characteristic of discriminating. And the smarter we are, the more clever we are at discriminating. We say that. He's very discriminating, right? We say that. The nature of discrimination is that we like and dislike, that we have preferences. And once there's preferring, there's going to be suffering. Because what we don't prefer is going to appear, and we'll be stuck with it from time to time. Remember the famous opening lines of the Xin Shen Ming that we've studied recently. The great way is easy, just avoid picking and choosing. And yet, once there's ignorance, once there's a subject and an object, there's going to be preferences. It's unavoidable. Then he says, after that comes the aspect of continuity. By virtue of the discriminating function of the intellect, the mind produces an awareness of pleasure and pain with regard to things in the world of objects. The mind, developing deluded thoughts and being bound to them, will then continue uninterrupted. Continuity. It just keeps on going. Third is the aspect of attachment. Because of the continuity, and this is a step by step, right? Because of the continuity of deluded thoughts, the mind superimposing its deluded thoughts on the world of objects and holding fast to the discriminations of liking and disliking develops attachment to what it likes. So there's no continuity necessarily, but we develop continuity through these steps, and then we have attachment. We have a fully developed world now of thinking and suffering and trouble. Because I'm this conditioned person, this is what I'm attached to, this is what I'm aversive to, this is what I like, this is what I don't like, and I'm out there negotiating a world. I have a memory, so I remember all that about myself. And my conditioning is very thick at this point. Very thick. Reinforced by a lot of thinking and a lot of emotion. And it wouldn't be so bad if I was the only one. But I'm not the only one. There's a whole world full of us. And we're bumping up against each other. And now we have all the ingredients that we need for real catastrophe, which we see, right? Right out there, everywhere we look. Fourth, back to Ashwagosa, is the aspect of the speculation on names and forms and letters, names and letters, concepts. On the basis of erroneous attachments, the deluded mind analyzes words which are provisional and therefore devoid of reality. I'm writing poems a lot, right? And I know that. I know words are devoid, and they don't refer to anything. I mean, they seem to, and that's what makes them interesting. But actually, no, words are words. And that's the final step that really gets us caught. We're caught now in our ideas. So these are building blocks, one building on the next, to build the full world of suffering that we see. And in this final step, we have the conceptual thinking, which leads to ideologies and beliefs, everyday beliefs, you know, like the room I wake up in is going to be the same as the room I woke up in, I went to sleep in last night, beliefs like that. But also big, complicated belief systems that cause, you know, huge strife among large groups of people. And then this gives rise to the fifth and final aspect, karma. Here's what the text says. Fifth is the aspect of giving rise to evil karma, relying on names and letters, investigates names and letters and words and becomes attached to them, and then creates manifold types of evil karma. Next is the aspect of anxiety attached to the effects of evil karma. Because of the law of karma, the deluded mind suffers the effects and will not be free. It should be understood that ignorance is able to produce all types of defiled states. All defiled states are aspects of non-enlightenment. So that with that, this section on the unenlightened aspect of the storehouse consciousness ends. And as I said, it describes now full-blown karma and its indelible effects. Karma is inescapable, even though the whole business is fundamentally unreal. Nevertheless, we have to suffer those unreal and painful consequences. Although reality is at all points compassionate and perfect, according to this awakening of faith, our inability to accept it as it is creates a chain of events that causes all this disturbance. However, seemingly, we need to go through all of this, otherwise, it wouldn't be like that. The fact that it is like that tells us that it must be like that. Because reality is reality. Reality doesn't make mistakes. We make mistakes, but our mistakes are reality. And reality doesn't make mistakes. So that means we have to practice. Because that's the kind of organism that we are. We have to do this. And the ultimate faith of Mahayana Buddhism is that we will do this, and we will one day, as a community of humans and other creatures on the earth, realize this perfect reality, and that there will be peace. This sort of millennial idea is very much in Mahayana Buddhism. It does give us that sort of hopeful vision for the future. Long time, you know, pretty long time, but it's always coming. One more thing, one last thing. That's letter, remember, there's three. Letter A, the enlightened aspect of storehouse conscious. Letter B, the unenlightened aspect. We just finished that. Letter C, the relationship between the enlightened and non-enlightened aspects. There are two relationships between the enlightened and the non-enlightened aspects. One, identity, and two, non-identity. Here's what it says about identity. Just as pieces of various kinds of pottery are of the same nature in that they are made of clay, so the various magic-like manifestations, unreal manifestations, of both enlightenment and non-enlightenment are aspects of the same essence, suchness. For this reason, it is said in a sutra that all sentient beings intrinsically abide in eternity and are entered into nirvana. The state of enlightenment is not something to be acquired by practice or to be created. In the end, it is absolutely unobtainable. It's unobtainable because it's already there. How can you get what you already have? Enlightenment is absolutely unobtainable. Also, it has no corporeal aspect that can be perceived as such. Any corporeal aspects, such as, you know, the glow of the Buddha and the Buddha's marks and so on, are visible magic-like products of suchness, manifested in accordance with the mentality of people in defilement. So the Buddha's appearances are our projections. It's not, however, that these corporeal states, which result from the supra-rational functions of wisdom that we talked about last time, are of the nature of non-emptiness, for wisdom has no aspects that can be perceived. So in other words, these things are just empty forms. So then, the other half is non-identity. Just as, and this is what the text says, just as various pieces of pottery differ from each other, so differences exist between the state of enlightenment and that of non-enlightenment. And this is what we see. We see there's a difference between enlightenment and non-enlightenment, and between the magic-like manifestations of suchness manifested in accordance with the mentality of people in defilement and those of people of ignorance who are defiled as to the essential nature of suchness. So this is saying, in a way, you could put it this way, actually nirvana and samsara are completely identical. And that is a very hopeful thing. You know, it gives us a lot of confidence and faith and patience with the world we live in. But the fact that nirvana and samsara are not identical gives us the need to practice. We have to practice, you know, and we have to have some urgency about it. It's a serious business, you know. We're in serious trouble, you know, each one of us and all of us together. We're in serious trouble here. I mean, I think that the world's troubles are not trivial. They're very, very serious. And so we have a kind of urgency in our need to practice. So on the one hand, everything is fine, really and truly. So we can rest and we can go to sleep at night without anxiety. And then we got to wake up in the morning and work hard at our practice because it's an urgent matter. Both those things are simultaneously the case. The end of the discussion of the three aspects of storehouse consciousness, the enlightened aspect, the unenlightened aspect, and the relationship between these two. The next thing coming, which obviously we're not getting into, is the causes and conditions of people being in samsara. That's the next thing. More bleak stuff. But I'll stop with a little piece from Suzuki Roshi and see again, in the light of what we were just saying, right, what we just read in the text, you'll hear all of it in this passage from Suzuki Roshi. And I think this is partly what Tracy quoted in her wonderful, wonderful talk last week. I think she referred to this same passage, so here it is again. It's on page 21, if you're interested. Because A tries to be C or D, there are problems. Renunciation is that A is just A, and A is bound to disappear. To practice renunciation is to be beyond forms and colors. We have full appreciation of forms and colors, meaning perception is to be beyond perception. We have full appreciation of forms and colors, but they are bound to disappear. And that's why we should not be caught by them. We do not give them up, but we accept that they go away. That is renunciation. And when you, if you think very, look very closely at your perceiving, you really think, we all think, you know, that we're going to have these things, that there are, that they will persist, and that they're ours. But that's never the case. And in the end, we always realize that has never been the case. But in the meantime, we're deluding ourselves. We don't give them up, but we accept that they go away. And we know that. That's renunciation. If A always tries to remain A, that is attachment to something which does not exist. It is delusion and not renunciation. There's no you that is persistent. There's just, we're all just a flash in the pan, you know, one after the other. And when we know that, that's renunciation. A should just be A, and A should vanish in the form of A, though it will appear again in some form of C or D, but C and D should not try to be something different from C and D. And C and D is you too, right? You're A and B and C and D. Every moment, another letter is the idea. When I was young, the other students and I used to discuss the goal of practice. We knew that the idea or the goal could not be the reality of it, and we wondered whether maybe practice was the bridge between the idea and the reality. We had this kind of discussion. You can see Suzuki Roshi sitting around, you know, smoking cigarettes with all the other monastics talking about this. But according to Dogen Zenji, practice is just practice Buddha. Bridge is just bridge Buddha. Reality is just reality Buddha. And idea is just idea Buddha. There is no problem. When you say, I am a human being, that's just another name for Buddha. Human being Buddha. So there's no need to have a bridge to the other shore. The other shore is the other shore Buddha. This shore is this shore Buddha. Everything is Buddha, just the names are different. And that's just like the pottery metaphor, right? Everything is clay. Just the different ways it's shaped is different, but it's all clay. Renunciation is attained by this shore being this shore and the other shore being the other shore. Only when A is A, only when we are satisfied with ourselves as A or as I, is there a chance to have renunciation, a chance to vanish. If A could be something else, then A might be a permanent being, but no such permanent being exists. Only when A is just A is it possible for A to vanish. Everything that exists must vanish. If you don't vanish, you would not exist. You would be a ghost. So we say, just to sit. A should be just A, and this just directly points out liberation from A. That's another word for suchness, is just this. You only lose your reality because you try to be something else. That's another way of saying you think there's enlightenment and non-enlightenment. You only lose your reality because you try to be something else. Do you understand? I should be just A, just I. Then I have liberation, enlightenment. I'm not caught, and I'm not a ghost. I exist here. I am Buddha. This is not some fancy teaching. No teaching could be more direct than just to sit. You cannot say anything about it, not even yes or no. This is not something you should believe in because I say so or because Buddha says so. This is the truth that is waiting to be found by you. It's the only way to attain renunciation without causing any problems for yourself or anyone. Just to be yourself is no problem whatsoever. This is what it means by just to sit. Moment after moment, you will find your own way when you just sit, when you are simply yourself. So thank you. You guys are amazing that you could sit there through this whole thing. I really appreciate it. Thank you. I'm always ready to stop when everybody starts walking out of the room. So, but you don't. So I keep going. Thank you. That's good. Okay, just to say that before we go into groups, we're going to sit on Saturday. And so those of you who are able to come in person to Green Gulch or online, we'll see you there. I usually do, for those who might be online, maybe you realize that we have little discussion groups that I come to, little Dokusan groups in the afternoon around 12:30 Pacific time. So if you come to the all-day sit, you can online, you can sign up for one of those groups. Okay, for discussion. This passage that I just read you from Suzuki Roshi is very directly related to the title of the book, you know, Becoming Yourself, right? He's talking all about becoming yourself. He talks about just being you, when you're just you. So I ask you to talk about this and think about this, each one of you. It's maybe a little hard to think about, but what's the difference for you as you hear this between just being yourself, just A is A, and the way you usually are yourself? Is there any difference? What is he talking about? What does he mean here? That seems to be what he's saying, right? There's a difference between just being yourself. And he seems to say it has something to do with knowing that you vanish. There's a difference between that and the way we usually are ourselves. Or is that? Is there a difference? So anyway, even though that might be impossible to talk about, give it a try. In groups of three, Shufi's going to set you all up. Thank you, Shufi. And I'll see you in... It will have 3 minutes. It's a little short. 3 minutes, 3 minutes, 3 minutes. 3 minutes at the end for extra comments. And then we'll come back in 12 to 15 minutes. And I'll see you then. Thank you again for listening. I really appreciate it. It's really, really, you're very patient people. Thank you. See you in about 15 minutes.